This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 7th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's time for us to set the day's agenda. Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson has the three stories we need to know.
North and South Korea have agreed to talks for the first time in over 2 years. The Japanese cabinet is bringing a National Security Council a step closer. And finally, Japan has said no to Taiwan's suggestion for three-way talks on the Senkaku Islands.
Plus, the crisis in Syria spreads. Israel moves in tanks as border skirmishes hit the Golan Heights. We ask, what will Israel do next?
And money, money, money. We speak to Felix Martin, the author of the new book Money, the Unauthorized Biography, who argues that we haven't really understood the real nature of money.
Plus, contestant, come on down. You could be Lebanon's next prime minister. A new reality show offers aspiring politicians a chance at power.
All that's coming up as we play some music too, all here on Midori House.
So a very busy show coming up ahead, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Turkey's Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan has urged the public not to be drawn into what he called violent protests, which have been taking place in Istanbul, Ankara and other cities over the past week. Speaking after a visit to North Africa, he told thousands of supporters at Istanbul airport that the protesters had looted shops and damaged businesses. He also said that accusations of excessive force by police were being investigated. Three people have been killed and around 4,000 more injured in the demonstrations, which began as a protest over a government decision to develop a park in Istanbul. These protesters say Erdogan's regime must go.
I think it has to be changed, absolutely. I think this is, the message from all these people is clear that Erdogan has no more place in this country right now.
We're here to support all these people for our rights to freely think and express ourselves, basically.
Austria is withdrawing its troops from the UN peacekeeping force on the Golan Heights after two soldiers were injured during a battle between Syrian government forces and rebel fighters at a crossing in the region. Rebel forces briefly took the town of Quneitra, about 50 miles southwest of the capital Damascus, but President Assad's forces seized it back a few hours later. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says recent reports that chemical weapons have been deployed may be used as a pretext for outside intervention in the crisis. His German counterpart, Guido Westerwelle, said President Assad should now allow independent investigators into Syria.
The growing number of reports that chemical agents may have been used in Syria on a limited scale is very worrying. We are following all reports in this regard very closely, and therefore it is high time for the Assad regime to grant full access to the independent UN experts' mission.
The Obama administration has acknowledged that it is collecting huge amounts of telephone records from at least one carrier. The admission comes after the British newspaper The Guardian published a secret court order related to the records of millions of Verizon communications customers on its website on Wednesday. The US government has defended the practice as necessary to protect Americans against attack, but the revelation has reopened the debate over privacy. Attorney General Eric Holder was questioned about the practice when he spoke to senators during a previously scheduled hearing on the Justice Department's budget. Republican Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois said he was concerned that spy agencies might have obtained the phone records of Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court, even if by accident.
Could you assure to us that no phones inside the Capitol were monitored of members of Congress that would give a future executive branch if they started pulling this kind of thing off? Would give them unique leverage over the legislature.
With all due respect, Senator, I don't think this is an appropriate setting for me to discuss that issue. I'd be more than glad to come back in an appropriate setting to discuss the issues that you have raised.
The World Bank says the world's poorest nations are set to nearly triple their spending on nutrition programs for mothers and children over the next 2 years to help cope with volatile food prices. The Washington-based global development lender said its direct funds for nutrition programs should rise from $230 million in 2011-2012 to $600 million for 2013-14. 90% of those funds will be dispersed through the World Bank's Fund for the Poorest, the International Development Association, and go largely to Africa and South Asia. Acting Vice President Keith Hansen said countries asked the World Bank for IDA funds for specific programs. And the increased funding showed that there's growing demand from countries themselves as they learn about the high health and social returns that nutrition creates. The German city of Dresden has been saved from severe flooding after the swollen River Elbe reached its expected peak of 9 metres. Had it risen another half metre, the defences would have been breached. Thousands of residents and emergency workers worked through the night filling sandbags and building up flood barriers. Thousands of people were evacuated and taken to makeshift emergency shelters. The floods brought on after a wet spring and sudden heavy rain have caused 13 deaths across central Europe. Defences also held firm in the Slovak capital Bratislava on the River Danube, but Hungary's capital Budapest is expecting high water on Monday. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has announced that he and his wife Lyudmila have divorced after 30 years of marriage. There had been growing speculation about the marriage after Mrs. Putin had rarely been seen in recent months. The couple announced the divorce on state TV after attending a ballet performance together. Mr. Putin said it was a joint decision as they rarely see each other and each has their own life. Mrs. Putin said it was a civilized divorce and they would always remain close. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney Burnham. It is 19.07 in Auckland, 15.07 in Singapore and 8.07 here in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House Live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. While joining us on the line from Tokyo is Monocle's bureau chief there, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, happy Friday. Thanks for coming on the show. Let's begin with North and South Korea, and I'm sure a lot of people going, here we go all over again.
Absolutely. I know. It's a familiar script, this, isn't it? After months of increasing rhetoric and all sorts of threats from the North, suddenly the North extended an invitation to talks to the South yesterday, and already they're talking about having pre-talks on Sunday and ministerial level talks next Wednesday in Seoul. So it's all happening very quickly now.
What can we expect from those meetings? Can we expect that North Korea is going to be a very easy negotiation partner?
Oh, yes, of course. No, absolutely not. You can imagine what will happen. It will not be about nuclear policy. I mean, that I think will be off the table. All it will be about will be economic issues. I think the big thing is the reopening of Kaesong. This is the big thing for North Korea. Is it's the area where South Korea opened factories. It's a sort of symbol of reconciliation. It was closed in April. The North closed it in a fit of pique. Withdrew its workers, and then the South withdrew its workers. And, that's the thing they want to reopen. It's a sort of important lifeline of hard currency for the North, and they want to get that started again.
Absolutely. The Kaesong Industrial Complex is definitely a lot more value to the North than it is to the South. It employs hundreds of workers there in the North. It provides millions of dollars in revenue. But is there a sense in South Korea that they are just absolutely getting fed up with this back and forth temper tantrum that the North loves throwing?
Well, I mean, I think, of course, South Korea is very sort of seasoned in these toings and froings. I mean, I think what's been happening this year has been slightly more dramatic. The level of rhetoric had gone up to a new level, threatening to send atomic bombs to America, sea of flames over Seoul. They were really very extreme. So I think, yes, the South is absolutely used to this. I think in a way the way it was reported from the outside was probably more dramatic than the way it was seen on the ground in Seoul. But I think the South Korean president, Park Geun-hye, she always kept the door open. I mean, she's only been in office since February. It's been quite a tricky few months for her. But she was very careful not to close the door on dialogue. She was quite firm, But at the same time, she kept the door open, and I think that policy has worked. And she gave a speech yesterday saying it was time for North Korea to end its isolationist stance.
So now we all know that North Korea wants to reopen Kaesong area, but knowing that in South Korea, do you think there's any chance for South Korea to get something else from these negotiations as well?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a start, you know, and that has not been the case. I mean, I think even to get Kaesong up and running again would be something. There's also talk about that there's a resort that was very popular with South Koreans in North Korea. It was the one place they could visit. That was closed in 2008. And there's talk about that reopening. So these are small things. But, you know, when dealing with North Korea, it's these tiny nuances that actually they're magnified. They're really important. And yes, further down the line, it could lead to something much more significant. But, you know, thought of six-party talk, that's all a long way off, I would have thought.
And another issue, Fiona, which is grabbing the headlines, an issue that we've covered here quite comprehensively, the conflict and the crisis really over the Senkaku Islands between Japan and China. We're actually going to be having a special series on Senkaku next week on The Globalist. But I understand now that Taiwan is putting their hand in and trying to lend a little help.
Yes, well, I mean, Taiwan also makes a claim on the Senkaku Islands itself, but it struck a deal with Japan in April, which basically allows Taiwanese fishermen to fish around the Senkaku Islands. It really annoyed China, this deal, but the Taiwanese have repeatedly said what they're most concerned about is fishing. It's a very rich source of fishing for Japanese and Taiwanese fishermen. So that deal was struck, and yesterday, President Ma of Taiwan suggested that perhaps there could be a three-way dialogue. Japan, China and Taiwan could get together to talk about the managing of resources. Well, I mean, that did not go down well in Japan, which is sticking to the stance that no, there isn't a territorial issue. Why on earth would Japan be negotiating over the resources? So it said no to that idea.
This dispute has been going on for so long. Does anyone really believe that this issue could be solved somehow?
I mean, it's rumbled on. I think, of course, in the last year, it's obviously got much, much more tense. You had the issue of the Japanese government effectively nationalising the Senkaku, buying them, which created a certain amount of tension, which was already there anyway. I mean, obviously, nobody wants to see military confrontation. We're going to be talking about all this next week, actually, when we go through the series. But I think, you know, diplomacy is the only way forward. There's absolutely no desire for conflict among any of the key players.
And Fiona, a third topic, which is quite fascinating. Since Abe's taken over the reins of power, he's really instituted a policy of nationalism in a sense, of course, with Abenomics, but in other ways as well. And now it looks like he's going to be taking things a step further with the proposal for a US-style National Security Council.
Well, I mean, this is not a new policy for Abe. He tried this when he was prime minister the first time. It got shot down. This time, it's been more successful. Certain events have happened, like North Korea. That's had a huge impact on his plans for a National Security Council. But also the events in Algeria earlier in the year where 10 Japanese nationals were killed when hostages were taken at a gas plant in Algeria. And Japan was left in a really embarrassing position, really, where it was trying to get intelligence. It was so behind. It was getting intelligence from other countries. And I think there's now a sense that Japan has to pool its resources. All the ministries have to get together and share the information they have. And until now, there's a feeling that each ministry, it's been a sort of vertical sharing of information within each ministry. There hasn't been much cross-sharing. And I think the idea behind the National Security Council is that these ministries will have to meet on a regular basis and they will have to share information.
When would all this begin?
Well, you know, it's not in place yet. Today the cabinet passed the bill, which will be going to the Diet. That the current Diet session ends on the 26th of June. So we'll see if they pass the bills in time. Yes, it could be coming in quite quickly.
That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson on the line for us, helping us to set the day's news agenda.
Coming up next, we're going to be heading to the Golan Heights, the latest hotspot in the fight for Syria.
Next weekend, come and join us for Monocle's very own take on an old English tradition. The second annual Monocle Country Fair will feature a selection of our favourite nations, retailers and delicacies. Wales, Colombia and Sweden will all be showcasing their wares, and we'll have clothing from Drake's, Henchman and Trunk. And of course, the all-press cart will be serving piping hot coffee throughout the weekend. Plus, we've got a petting zoo for the little ones. So come down to Midori House on Dorset Street, Marylebone, London, next weekend for the second annual Monocle Country Fair. And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Some sheep there in the background with Sophie, Marcus. Are you gearing up for the summer fair?
Absolutely. Only a week and a half to go.
Do you have your role yet? Do you know what you're going to be doing?
I don't. No one's told me. Last year I was singing Kiev Tombola.
So that's lots to look forward to then.
I loved it.
Well, up next we're going to be heading to the Golan Heights because battles between rebel forces and the Bashar al-Assad's forces continues to spill over the border, this time hitting the politically fragile Golan Heights. Rebel and Syrian troops clashed near the town of Quneitra, the only land crossing between Syria and Israel, and a symbolically very important place. Now, while Israel moved tanks and some troops to the crossing on their side, Syrian troops claim to recapture the area from rebel forces.
During the fighting, two UN soldiers were injured. Austria, who makes up one third of the 900 permanently based United Nations soldiers there, said they were pulling out because of an unacceptable threat. The fighting along the Golan Heights marks an important precedent, raising new questions over what role Israel will play in Syria's civil war. Joining us now to discuss this is Noam Shaizav, political analyst for 972 magazine in Tel Aviv. Noam, what is the latest regarding this situation now?
Well, Israel is demanding a UN force that will replace the Austrian forces that are pulling out. There is a high alert in the Golan Heights around the Quneitra region, and farmers in the Israeli side of the border were prevented from going to their fields because the authorities are afraid that someone might get hurt, something that would only escalate things. But except for that, I think that the Israeli side is cautiously monitoring the situation and very careful not to intervene.
Well, what has been the reaction from Netanyahu and his defense chiefs? Is there a sense that they're going to be raising the alert level? Are they going to be moving more troops and more tanks to the Golan Heights in case there is a future incursion?
Well, so far there hasn't been a mobilization or anything similar. There is a permanent Israeli force in the area, but and from Israel there are two main concerns. One is the removal of the UN forces, or at least one third of them, and the other is the entry of Syrian troops into the demilitarized zone. Quneitra itself is a demilitarized city. And according to the latest report, there have been at least three regime tanks in the city during the fighting, which is a violation of the agreement between Israel and Syria from 1974, and Israel has filed a complaint to the UN.
And this land crossing between Syria and Israel, it's got very much of a symbolic nature, but how crucial is it, say, for the Syrian rebels? Are they going to get significantly weaker if this crossing is controlled by the governmental forces?
Well, the area is one of several routes from south to north in Syria, but the crossing itself is mostly of symbolic importance. One of the elements that makes sovereignty in international relations is control over borders, and we know that the rebels control several borders in the north of the country and in the border with Iraq, and getting hold of the main or the only border with Israel is a huge symbolic achievement for the rebels. But in terms of personnel, troops or arms, there isn't much going on in this crossing. Only the occasion humanitarian Druze native who is allowed to cross, and several tons of apples which are transferred every year, but nothing too crucial.
And Noam, outside of this crossing, Hezbollah, a key player in the conflict, has vowed in recent weeks that it would facilitate attacks on Israel through the Golan Heights. It's leaving Israel and Netanyahu in a very precarious position here, it seems, because there seems to be a sense of real paralysis in Israeli society over which options are the ones that the Israelis should go ahead with.
Well, this is something, the conflict is definitely spilling over. It's spilling over to Lebanon, it's spilling over to Turkey, and now to Israel. In the last month, there was an Israeli attack in Syria proper, and there was for the first time an exchange of fire between regime forces and IDF forces in the Golan Heights, for which the regime took responsibility. And that's a main threshold there, that the regime, the Syrian regime, takes responsibility for shooting at IDF forces, and we'll have to see if this continues. I think that both the political system and the public in Israel are united in the feeling that Israel should not intervene, only as a last resort in this conflict.
I was just going to ask about the public debate. Is there actually any debate, or is there just, you know, is everyone really agreeing that much that there is no discussion on what to do with Syria?
I think the debate in many ways echoes the international debate dilemma right now, which is what side to back and if all. The Israeli public in the beginning was very much anti-Assad because of the Iranian support for Assad and the Assad support for the Hezbollah. But right now there is a growing concern from the forces that could take over once the fighting ended, if the regime indeed falls. But from what I hear, even in the security establishment, there are a lot of people who still think that Israel's best interest is to see the regime falls, and whoever comes instead of Assad will clearly be better.
Noam Shaizef, many thanks for joining us here on Midori House. Noam Shaizef, a political analyst there with 972 Magazine in Tel Aviv.
It is 15:21 in Shanghai, 8:21 here in London, and just 21 minutes past midnight if you are in San Francisco. Do you think you have the right relationship with money, Phil Hahn?
I have a bad relationship with money. It's the bane of my life. Let me just put it that way.
The next question would have been, can you handle your finances? Well, there's,
what do you think?
There's an author who's called Felix Martin, and he basically says that no one actually knows enough about money. In his latest book, Money, the Unauthorized Biography, he argues that we don't really know what we are talking about when it comes to money issues.
And according to him, we have understood the history of money completely wrong. And we haven't just got it wrong, we've got it dangerously wrong. In the book, Martin has taken on the job of explaining in detail the essentials, what money is, where it comes from, and how it works. Monocle producer Alad John spoke to Felix Martin earlier.
Let's begin by, perhaps, if you could broadly outline, why did you want to write this book?
Well, this book is the story of the two main ways of thinking about money that there have been historically. The first of those ways is what I'd call the conventional understanding of money. And that is that, you know, in the olden days, money was something physical. And then at some point, someone had the bright idea of lending and borrowing these, and that was the invention of credit. And then even later, institutions evolved that specialized in actually building and managing those superstructures of credit on top of this physical money. That view has been very dominant in the course of the history of economic thought, that explanation for how money evolved and what it is. As a matter of fact, it's historically not accurate, and historians and anthropologists have known that for a long time. And it's logically quite misleading about a lot of important aspects of money. So the alternative view takes almost exactly the opposite view of money. It says, look, money is basically a set of ideas. The idea, the concept of monetary value, economic value, a concept of value that can be applied to anything. So it's not like sentimental value or religious value or aesthetic value. They have their own spheres they can be applied in. Monetary value, you can apply it to anything. You can value human lives, you can value chickens in the marketplace, you know, all these types of things. The second important idea is the institution of accounting for credits and debts, how I can build up a credit against you and you can build one up against me. And the third thing is the institution of transferability. You can transfer your debt to me to someone else in order to settle an unrelated transaction. And these things together, they make up money. And all the physical stuff, coins and lots of interesting things which have been used as currency over the ages, they're interesting in their own right, and they are quite historically important in some respects, but really they're not the key thing. If you want to understand how money works, and if you want to understand, for example, how it has contributed to some of our current problems, it's much, much better to take that second view of money.
The opening chapter focuses on this. It's a wonderful story of the island of Yap in the Pacific Islands. You focus on the adventures of a young anthropologist, an American adventurer called William Furness. Why don't you try and tell some of his story and why that island features as such a prominent part of your book.
Sure, certainly. It's a lively story. Furness was, as you said, an anthropologist, and he'd spent a lot of time in Borneo, and then he decided in 1903 to make this trip to the island of Yap, which is really an extremely remote island, very close to the equator in the middle of the Pacific. And he got there, and he immediately saw that it was a very, very primitive sort of place. There were hardly any commodities. And he expected to find, you know, in such a simple place as most people would, that this was a society which would operate by barter. But he discovered something quite different. He discovered that this was a society with a very sophisticated monetary system. And it was impossible not to notice it because the currency, the coins of this monetary system, were enormous great big stone discs, some of them 12 feet across. So unfortunately, this posed a bit of a challenge for his theory, because usually people say, oh, well, the thing that's chosen as the medium of exchange, and it must be chosen because it's portable and small,
malleable,
and easier to carry around, all that kind of stuff. And of course, the thing about these enormous stone discs is that they were extremely difficult to carry around. In fact, most of them were completely unable to be moved. But he pointed out that actually these Yappies were a very philosophical people, because they didn't care that you couldn't move these coins around, because they understood that what was really important was the system of credit accounts they were keeping against one another and the clearing of those. So actually very rarely would they even need to move these coins. They would trade with one another, build up credits against one another, offset them against each other, and only perhaps at the end of a day or a week or a month would they then exchange coins in order to clear the outstanding balances.
Is that a clear example of what you term the credit and clearing kind of idea versus this sort of medium of exchange which we've become accustomed to?
It is. I mean, that's of course, so I'm using it as an example of that in the book, and that's what Keynes said in this review that he wrote in 1915 of the book. He said these people have a more philosophical view of money, and there's a great deal that we could learn from them. And what he meant was exactly that, which was that the way that they were thinking about their monetary system was much clearer, because for them it was obvious that these stone coins could only be tokens, whereas for us it's very easy, historically it's been very easy, to get confused by that. And the confusion is, you know, it's not just cosmetic, it's not just wrong, as it were, it can also be quite dangerous.
That's exactly what I'd like to move on to, if we could. I mean, obviously, the financial collapse, there's huge seismic changes in the financial industries. How can we attribute the dangers of modern finance to perhaps a misconceived idea of whether it's a credit and clearing idea or a barter system?
Sure, it's a very good question. What I try to describe in the book is how deeply ingrained this conventional view of money has been in modern orthodox economics. And modern orthodox economics is going to be very esoteric for most people and most of your listeners, but it is very important because it's how central bankers and Ministry of Finance people and so on think about money. And I'll give you an example of two ways that it's important to take the alternative view of money. The first is the question of monetary policy. We have become accustomed to thinking of monetary policy, that's the interest rate setting by central banks and so on, as being all about basically keeping the currency very stable and just providing enough currency for the needs of trade so that we can have low inflation. And indeed, in normal times, that's a very respectable thing to be doing. However, in abnormal times, and we now live in very abnormal times, when you have huge build-ups of debt between one group of people and another, so we've got huge hangover of debt in the public sector and the private sector, there is another thing which monetary policy can do. By creating a bit more inflation, 5, 6, 7% a year for several years, you can engineer a big transfer of wealth from creditors in the economy to debtors. And thinking about that aspect of monetary policy, the redistributive aspect of monetary policy, is very difficult to do if you think of money as a thing. It makes much more sense if you think of money as credit, and therefore something which inflation depreciates the value of and shifts wealth from one person to another. So it gives you a clearer view of monetary policy. And the second thing I'd like to mention is about banking. Again, taking this other view of money brings clearly into perspective that banking is very political. The question is, if you take this view of money as credit and clearing, who controls this system? And what you find if you look back over the real history of banking is that it is effectively done, it's a way of producing private money, issuing private money by commercial banks under license from the state. And there's a quid pro quo there. Banks are allowed to issue private money in exchange for being regulated by the state. And the origins of that are in a great monetary settlement that was made in 1694 when the Bank of England was introduced, the first sort of progenitor of modern central banks. And the crisis that we've just seen was the result of that great monetary settlement breaking down, of private banks being able to issue private money outside of the control of the state. And so what we need is a new great monetary settlement.
And that was Monocle's Alad John there, speaking with author Felix Martin on his new book, Money, the Unauthorized Biography. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we get the local discussion topics from our man in Belgrade. We go through this day's North American papers and... we find out about a new way to enter the politics in Lebanon through a television talent show.
But before all of that, here is Mr. Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Phil. Turkey's Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan has urged the public not to be drawn into what he called violent protests, which have been taking place in Istanbul, Ankara and other cities over the past week. Three people have been killed and around 4,000 more injured in the demonstrations, which began as a protest over a government decision to develop a park in Istanbul. Austria is withdrawing its troops from the UN peacekeeping force on the Golan Heights after two of its soldiers were injured during a battle between Syrian government forces and rebel fighters at a crossing in the region. The Obama administration has acknowledged that it is collecting huge amounts of telephone records from at least one carrier. The admission comes after the British newspaper The Guardian published a secret court order related to the records of millions of Verizon communications customers on its website on Wednesday. The World Bank says the world's poorest nations are set to nearly triple their spending on nutrition programs for mothers and children over the next 2 years to help cope with volatile food prices. The Washington-based global development lender said its direct funds for nutrition programs should rise from $230 million in 2011-2012 to $600 million for 2013-14. The German city of Dresden has been saved from severe flooding after the swollen river Elbe reached its expected peak of 9 metres. Had it risen another half metre, the defences would have been breached. Thousands of residents and emergency workers worked through the night, filling sandbags and building up flood barriers. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has announced that he and his wife, Lyudmila, have divorced after 30 years of marriage. He said it was a joint decision as they rarely see each other and each has their own life. She said it was a civilised divorce and they would always remain close. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi and Phil Hahn. The time is 8.32 here in London and it's 9.32 in Belgrade where we head now.
Joining us on the line from Belgrade is our man there, Guy Delaney. Welcome to the show, Guy. A story which we covered quite heavily last week was this acquittal of two Serbian intelligence officers. They were found not guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. They've arrived back in Serbia now.
That's right. And it was quite a low-key return. I think this is very interesting what's happened with this, that in contrast, when you had two Croatian generals who were acquitted on appeal of crimes against humanity towards the end of last year, there was a huge public celebration in Zagreb to mark the men's return. Well, we've now had these two men acquitted in Serbia, and it's been a very quiet return from them. They just came back on a private government plane, didn't make any comment when they arrived. Certainly no public celebrations, because I think everybody's aware it's slightly awkward, even for Serbia, that this has happened. Serbian people often look at the Hague Tribunal and say it's very good at convicting Serbs, but not very good at convicting anybody else. But on this occasion, two Serbs have been acquitted. But these Serbs were high up in Slobodan Milosevic's regime during the 1990s, the head of state security service and the head of special operations, very close allies of Slobodan Milosevic. So for these two men to be coming back into Belgrade acquitted of all charges is a slightly uncomfortable moment, really, for people in modern Serbia.
Guy, how would you describe people's relationship with The Hague?
It's troubled. I think, you know, the way it works is this. As I've mentioned, in Serbia, people are quite suspicious of it because crimes against Serbs, and there were more Serbs who were forced out of their homes during the Balkan conflict than people of any other ethnicity, and people haven't really been convicted of those crimes. And that goes down very badly in Serbia, where I think people recognise that the atrocities that were committed by Serbs must be prosecuted, whether it's by The Hague or by the local courts. They also want people who committed crimes against Serbs to be brought to justice. So that's what's happening in Serbia. What you tend to see happening in other places like Kosovo and Croatia, where people have been victims as well, is that they like The Hague when the verdicts go the way they want them to go, but they don't like it when they don't. So in this case in Croatia, the reaction has been, well, this absolves Slobodan Milosevic of responsibility because these men were charged with organising the militias which had ethnically cleansed areas of Bosnia and Croatia during the conflict. And that would have been a joint criminal enterprise with Milosevic, thereby dragging the Serbian state into it. And they've been cleared of it. And Croatia's outrage. There was a tweet from Strobe Talbot, former foreign policy advisor to the United States government in the 90s, saying that it was a smack of base politics, this decision by The Hague. So quite extraordinary to see somebody of his standing criticizing a court which is of the standing of The Hague Tribunal.
And Guy, these trials and these tribunals, they last for a long time. We're talking 10, 20 years. Is there a growing sense, not in your region, that people are just, you know, saying it's not worth the time, it's not worth the money, it's not worth them even being at The Hague?
I think the problem is, do they do anything to achieve reconciliation? It has just marked its 20th anniversary, The Hague Tribunal. But as we've just mentioned, the way the verdicts go, there doesn't seem to be any consensus drawn or any sort of closure drawn from people who have been convicted or have been acquitted or the facts which have come out. There are certainly human rights campaigners here, people like Natasha Kandic, who is a Serb lawyer, human rights lawyer, who campaigned for years to have people from Serbia prosecuted at The Hague so that the victims could get justice, saying that the thing which these tribunals tend to forget is the victims, and that that they go after this idea of international justice, joint criminal enterprise, which is something which started in Italy originally with mafia trials, and they're not really set up to provide justice for the victims or reconciliation for a region that badly needs it.
Another news story from your direction. Belgrade has joined dozens of other local governments in Serbia that have adopted declarations against genetically modified organisms. Why is this significant?
Well, you know, I like this because it's a very Serbian sort of thing to do. One of the things that you first notice when you come to Serbia and you eat in the restaurants is, number one, that the fresh produce is magnificent and tastes wonderful. I've never tasted tomatoes like Serbian tomatoes. They're quite something. But you'll also notice that they're all sorts of odd shapes, that they're not the standard uniform shapes we're used to finding now in the UK because of EU regulations and the supermarkets. People actually take pride in the individuality of their produce. They take pride in things being domaci, which is homemade. So, you know, you don't want the factory bottled Slivovica. You want the homemade one that somebody's made from their own plum trees. It's that sort of thing. So standing up against genetically modified foods is a stance which says we're proud of what we produce locally and we don't want to be sucked into this global game of industrialized food.
And it's interesting, you mentioned the European Union there. Their neighbor, Serbia's neighbors, Croatia, joining the EU very shortly. Are they kind of watching with anticipation over how they're going to deal with these slew of regulations?
I think they are, because of course Serbia's negotiating to join the EU itself. It hasn't got a date for talks yet, but it's hoping to get the green light by the end of this month, actually. Croatia joins on the 1st of July. And I've talked to people like olive farmers in Croatia, and they're really concerned. They think that they're going to be, instead of being opening up to a great big new market of 27 other countries, they're worried that they're going to get swamped by people who know the game a lot better than they do. And this is certainly the concern for people in Serbia. It's a small country, 7 million people, not as small as Croatia. But nonetheless, it will be looking with great interest and I think concern about what happens, particularly in the field of agriculture, to Croatia after the 1st of July.
And moving on to another story, Museum of Contemporary Art in Belgrade has actually finally staged an event for the first time in 6 years.
Yeah, indeed. The last one was an exhibition of the Young British Artists. That's how long ago it was. And the Young British Artists, who aren't so young anymore. But it's actually had an exhibition this week as part of Belgrade Design Week. It closed for renovations 6 years ago. And these renovations have been interminable and some might say a bit of a mirage, which is a real shame because it's a very striking building. It's on the new Belgrade side of the river here in Belgrade. You can spot it if you're up in the fortress. It's a very obvious, striking, modern building. Any city would be proud to have it as a landmark. But at the moment, it's a landmark that's doing very little except for this small temporary exhibition this week.
Excellent stuff, Guy. I hope you have some time to check out that Design Week event in Belgrade. That was Guy Delaney for us in Belgrade. Many thanks.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a report on a different talent show in Lebanon, one that may kickstart a political career for someone lucky.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. The time is 14:41 in Jakarta, it's 10:41 in Beirut, and 8:41 here in London.
A television show where contestants have to fulfill several challenges, outwit their opponents, and win the affection of the voting public. Does this sound familiar? Well, the reality TV craze has reached the Middle East, and one intrepid Lebanese broadcaster has set up a show for wannabe politicians. It is called Al Zaim, Arabic for the leader, and aims to undermine the omnipresent patronage networks that dominate Lebanese politics. The winner was promised a political campaign funded by the broadcaster.
The potent mix of entertainment and politics has been a hit with the ratings, but is this really, as the show's producers claim, a way to re-engage the electorate? And given that this year's Lebanese elections have been postponed, is the 27-year-old economics graduate who won the thing ever actually going to get his chance to win again? Well, Monocle's Rebecca Collard reports from Beirut.
Maya Tarrou is not a typical Lebanese politician in any way. Just 27 years old, female, and openly agnostic, she's far from the usual candidate that runs for Lebanon's heavily sectarian, male-dominated parliament. But earlier this year, Maya won a political reality television show called El Zaim, or The Leader. And as a result, she's having her political campaign funded and promoted by the television station that aired the program.
There's like a misrepresentation or ill representation, a low representation, call it what you want, of the youth, of the people who share my beliefs. We are like people who believe in a secular, non-sectarian Lebanon, where the only thing that will get you where you want is your competency and nothing else.
Today, Maya is meeting with staff at Al Jadid, or New Television, who ran the show Al Zaim and who are supervising and supporting her campaign. Karma Kayat is one of the show's creators. She says the show was inspired by the fact that issues that are important to youth are sidelined in the current political system.
I was sitting with a group of friends, and it was actually a discussion going on between us, and we were speaking about elections, and then someone asks, why isn't there something like that on TV? Just like any other idea. And then from that then on, it clicked, why don't we have a reality TV show that actually introduces new youth into the show? Because all the people that were sitting were actually, there were you, of course, from the youth, and they didn't belong to any political party, but they were interested in politics and really, you know, would have liked having a chance.
Lebanese politics have long been dominated by families. It's common to have the sons of members of parliament run for political positions, and for party leaders to hand power to their sons when they leave the arena. On top of that, running a campaign in Lebanon is expensive, and for middle-class youth like Maya, coming up with the funds just to register as an independent would be almost impossible.
And this is causing the political life in Lebanon to become sort of chaotic, null, and dull at the same time, because history keeps repeating itself and repeating itself negatively. There are many people in Lebanon, youth and normal citizens, whom actually have good standings and they have very good beliefs that could actually really implement change in the country, whom are never even given a chance to show themselves, reveal themselves, and compete in this domain. This is initially the main purpose of the show.
Over 1,000 people applied to be in Alzheimer's. Out of these, 15 competed on screen. Each week, the contestants were given challenges, societal or political problems in their country to solve. And then one of the wannabe leaders was voted off the show by viewers, using SMS or internet voting, in a Survivor meets American Idol format. Karma says they face surprising and at times dangerous challenges.
Since we face problems on the ground, which we had to solve on the spot. Sometimes they'd be going to do something, for instance, just to try to solve something that has to do with electricity, and suddenly Salafis with guns attacks them.
The final group presented their 10-point political platform on air in hope of winning the bid for a funded political campaign. In the final episode, Maya stood against Nicholas Haruni, closer in likeness to a typical Lebanese parliamentary candidate. But in the end, she won out and was presented with the prize by Lebanon's prime minister. But the prize, a funded political campaign, may not be put to use anytime soon. The Lebanese parliament extended their term for up to 18 months, meaning elections could be postponed to 2014. Despite that, Maya is staying active. Maya has co-founded a nonprofit called Food Blessed, which provides basic food supplies to families in need. Today, we're heading to a garden show where she'll be squeezing oranges into juice to raise money. Winning Alzheimer has given Maya the sort of celebrity in Beirut, usually reserved for pop singers and actors. At the garden show, she's approached by strangers. Alzheimer is not Lebanon's only new political reality show. The State Academy will be airing later this year and is now asking for Lebanese people to submit their ideas for projects that will improve their country. Both shows are hoping to change the political and social dynamics in this small but strife-ridden nation of 4 million people.
Stupidity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And this is what happens here. So every time we have elections, people nag and say, oh, no one's there to, no one really cares. And then they give their votes or voices to the same person because he's the son of a good leader, or his dad was a parliamentary deputy, or because he's a prominent figure in the society, or because he has the money. Everything but because his electoral platform is really a good platform.
Sitting not far away is 67-year-old Hani Ranim, a farmer from the Shouf Mountains outside Beirut. Hani says he agrees with the principle of voting outside one sect, and that he'd support anyone he thought would make a good leader, but admits he's always voted for Walid Jumblatt, leader of his Druze sect, and before that, his father Kamal Jumblatt. ...27-year-old Hani Al Hassan says this is the biggest problem in Lebanese politics, this blind following of leaders.
We have, in our young generation, I'm not sure if it's different mentality, but it's a different way of doing things, or thinking. We're not following the old decisions because the circumstances of those decisions, and we're trying to make a change. This is Maya's slogan. You have to change yourself to make a change.
This is a growing divide in Lebanon between older Lebanese who have lived through a bitter sectarian civil war and decades of a stunted political system, and youth like Maya, who are seeking ways to change their fractured country and move past these political traditions. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Rebecca Collard.
come.
And you know, that story made me wonder, Phil, if you knew a television talent contestant from this kind of a show, would you actually trust this person and want to vote for this kind of person?
I guess it would depend. You know, it's a very novel idea, isn't it? But I guess it would depend on their policies and how they actually stood for it. But I would vote for you if you ran for Finnish Parliament.
Really?
Yeah, I think you've got the look, you've got the voice, you've got the demeanor, you've got the brains, sex appeal.
Do you know me? Do you know me well enough, Phil?
Well, I can get to know you.
Uh-huh.
Anyways.
Anyway, it's 11 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House.
In a moment, we're going to be having a look through today's US front pages with our Danny Giacopelli. But first, to take us there, here's Stillness is the Move by the New York group Dirty Projectors. And that was Stillness is the Move by Dirty Projectors.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn. It is 19:52 in Auckland and 8:52 here in London. Joining us now in the studio, we have Daniel Giacopelli for a flick through the US papers. And it seems, basing on these papers, it seems that this is not a good day to be working in the PR departments on different parts of the planet, Danny.
Of many big tech companies around the world, specifically in the U.S. So the Washington Post just broke this story. It's the most fascinating, outrageous story I've read this entire month. I mean, Americans should be kind of outraged at this. So earlier we had seen that the government was reading phone records in the States, and that kind of caused this big commotion. People were very, you know, saying it's you know, human rights were being taken away and everything. And now what's come out, the Washington Post just broke the story that the government has actually been working with nine of the biggest tech companies in the United States by basically getting access to their servers and having a free-for-all of all the information they want, photos, videos, audio, chat logs, basically anything they want.
But this is, they've been targeting foreigners who are overseas. Is that right? Or
well,
is it America? Or is the argument that they've been targeting Americans on American soil?
Well, they are. I mean, the argument is that it's kind of flimsy rules around this, and that Americans in America, not doing any kind of communications from outside of the world, are being targeted, and that's surely a possibility. This was actually leaked from an intelligence officer who he had a PowerPoint that looks like it was made in like 1995, and he leaked it to the Washington Post, and it basically outlined the entire program. And it's a voluntary program. That's the kind of amazing thing about it. It's not mandatory. These companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, Skype, YouTube, they're voluntarily allowing access to their servers to the government. One of the comments was that it's chilling. They could actually see what you're typing. What's also interesting is that immediately, all of the companies, not immediately, over the course of a couple hours after the story was breaking, all of these companies denied it. They said, no, we're not giving our information out. We've never heard of this or this thing called PRISM at all.
Danny, your next story is about the U.S. politics.
Yeah, so Obama had made these nominations. Susan Rice, who is the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., she's now going to be the national security advisor, and Samantha Power, which we've been covering, has been nominated to be in Susan Rice's former role. And obviously, as we predicted, the Republican backlash has begun. Mitt Romney has come out saying he finds it a disappointing appointment on the part of the president, which I guess is expected.
Because many people thought that Susan Rice's career, political career, was essentially over because of her involvement in the Benghazi September 11th attacks in Libya last year. She was initially planned, at least thought was going to be the next Secretary of State, but because that position needs Senate confirmation, Republicans said, you know, there's no way that was going to happen. So she kind of went into the woodwork. Now she's back, though, in a position that doesn't require Senate approval. Politically, it's very smart of Obama, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's really nothing they can do about it now. That's one of the tricky things with those points in the White House is that, you know, well, you don't need Senate confirmation. So
Are there any plans that Samantha Power could be, her vote could be held up?
She's going to have a tough road ahead, I think. I mean, I'm not sure, but lots of people are digging up things about her, and she's going to have a tough time. I wanted to also turn to the LA Times. 3/4 of Americans now say same-sex marriage has reached the point in which it's certain to become legal. Now, that doesn't equate to them accepting it.
Exactly.
So they're just saying, yeah, well, you know, it's bound to happen. Of those people, 59% oppose the idea and 85% support it, which, you know, gradually Americans are more coming around to the idea, which is remarkable. In the past decade, the tide of people supporting gay marriage has just been remarkable.
It really looks like there is a lot of momentum for all that at the moment. Things are going forward very fast. Well, one more story from New York. Things are moving forward quite fast over there as well in terms of how to get a cab.
Yeah, quite literally fast. Yeah, so in New York, one of the problems of living in New York is that it's not always easy to get a cab, especially if you live in the outer boroughs like the Bronx or Brooklyn or Queens.
Where are you from?
I'm from Long Island, which is not a borough, but it's close enough. We're proud from Long Island. But now Mayor Bloomberg is making it a legal right to hail a cab in all 5 boroughs, something that, you know, it's really a long time
coming. So what is the reason why that hasn't been legal this far?
Discrimination, Marcus. I mean, I don't know. They're bringing out these new lime green cabs soon. I don't know if you've seen them. They're replacing
the yellow cab?
Well, I don't know if they're completely replacing them, but they're coming out with these lime green cabs.
You don't look like you approve. The look on your face.
The classic New York cab
should be yellow.
The iconic yellow cab. Yeah.
In fact, it should be checkered if we're going back to the old days when it was. But I digress.
I completely agree with you, Monocle's producer, Daniel Ciccapelli. Thank you for going through the papers with us.
Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producers, Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney. They have done a standout job over the last 2 weeks here on Midori House. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was the very talented Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is Section D with Alad John. I'll be back with Cordelia Lynch for Midori House at the same time on Monday. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marco Seppi.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.